It has been said that a half-truth, masquerading as the whole truth, is a complete untruth. Now, there are some half-truths that we can accept, like a koala bear isn't really a bear, it's a marsupial. Or when someone says, I'll be there in a minute, and they're like 5, 10, 15 minutes late, we can accept that. But the half-truth that has been told for the last century about women's suffrage has become an outright lie. The story that has been passed down to us about the women's right to vote has been, at best, a half-truth, at worst, an outright lie. The suffrage narrative, as it has been told, is through the eyes of its two main heroines, Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony. These two women were so convinced that their fight to vote was history-making that they literally wrote the history on suffrage. Their most well-known book was literally called History of Women's Suffrage, a six-volume, nearly 6,000-page series published from 1881 to 1922. These women controlled the past because they wrote it. So through their perspective, the story of the women's right to vote is told in such a way that you might not stop to think that there were thousands of unnamed, unknown, and unhonored women involved in the success of the movement. Told in such a way that would have you believe that there were no black women spearheading efforts in the suffrage movement. That's why you hear so much about Susan B. Anthony and so little of Ida B. Wells Barnett. You know so much about Elizabeth Cady Stanton, but not Sojourner Truth. We hear about Lucretia Mott, but not Frances Ellen Watkins Harper. As a matter of fact, so many other black women and women of color. Sarah Redman, Mary Church Terrell, Mabel Pinkwiley, I could go on. And when I first wrote this podcast, it was the 2020 anniversary of women's right to vote, the 100-year anniversary. But I said it was a half-truth to say that it was the 100th-year anniversary because it was the 100th-year anniversary of white women's right to vote. Black women and other women of color were denied access, suppressed, and denied the success of attaining the vote until the Voting Rights Act became law in 1965. Native Americans of any gender were not allowed to vote until 1924. Then, it was only in theory, it would also take them until 1965 to begin to get comprehensive voting rights. So here's what this story is not. This isn't an attempt to discount the contributions and revolutionary genius of the white women who suffered and fought bitterly for their voting rights. It is every attempt to recount the stories of all women's contributions and revolutionary genius who suffered and fought bitterly for their rights. And while I'm at it, I won't hide the racist and bigoted views by some of the white women in the movement whose behavior might have rivaled a slithering rattlesnake. Women that almost tore the movement apart and derailed it altogether. It is also an attempt to include the men, the immigrants, and the Native American brothers and sisters who threw blows in the fight for equality. This is an attempt at the whole truth of women's suffrage. It is in the spirit of Mary Church Terrell, an unsung black heroine of women's voting rights, that I tell this story out of a deep respect and honoring of all the women who lifted their voices in order to lift their ballots. When she said, quote, "And so lifting as we climb, onward and upward we go, struggling and striving and hoping that the buds and blossoms of our desires will burst into glorious fruition. With courage born of success achieved in the past, with a keen sense of the responsibility which we shall continue to assume, we look forward to a future large with promise and hope. Seeking no favors nor patronage, we knock at the bar of justice, asking an equal chance," unquote. I think the undying lesson of women's suffrage resounds in this message, for we can learn from history. We can learn from the successes and failures of this movement. The lesson is this: as we continue to climb up that proverbial ladder to equality and justice, always lift up those who are below you. Welcome to the Humanity Archive podcast, everyone. I am your gracious host, Jermaine Fowler, and today I have a story of gender, equality, triumph, tragedy, bitterness, racism, betrayal, allies, brothers and sisters, and enemies, and one of struggle and courage and progress. Today, we are going to get into the fascinating story of suffrage. This is the story of women's right to vote. Stay tuned. You won't believe what you're about to hear. Now, let's get into it. Today's episode is brought to you by my Patreon page. And that's patreon.com/the Humanity Archive. And there, what are you going to get? 3 to 4 extra podcasts every month. And I have a show over there. It's called Reflections of Humanity. It's a shorter show where I go into a broad range of topics ranging from history to philosophy and everything in between. The same energy and spirit of the Humanity Archive podcast. You've got to check it out. It's a beautiful show. And then you also get access to my book club, where we choose a book every single month, and then you get to hang out with me via Zoom. And then you also get access to my Zoom office hours, where you get to hang out with me every month via Zoom as well. And then on top of that, you get 20% off all of my online history courses forever as a thank you for being a sustaining donor of the Humanity Archive. The Humanity Archive is everything to do with telling the stories of the historically unheard, intellectually stimulating conversation, curiosity-driven, knowledge-pursuing community. Book lovers, intellectual adventurers, all welcome. So join me on patreon.com/the Humanity Archive and get all of those benefits and community with others like you and me who want to learn every single day. Now let's get back into women's suffrage. So to talk about women's suffrage and women's inability to vote is to continue a very long history of global oppression against women that has taken on many forms and faces. It can be said that oppression against women is the oldest form of oppression because it has been going on for millennia after millennia. Recognizing this fact, one inevitably begins to question, what were the beginnings of this subordination of women? Has it existed since the beginning of society? Did it start with agriculture, with property ownership? When did men get this power? Now, I want to be fair and say that gender isn't some monolithic thing where all men or all women are exactly alike. It's more fluid. We also come from different races and religions and classes and different experiences and a million other things that inform how we relate to one another as humans in the world. But at the same time, in Western culture, in America and elsewhere, patriarchy has been the common denominator. So from a historical perspective, I often examine how that shaped male development, including my own. How have my thoughts and actions been affected by this social hierarchy that has placed men above women politically, economically, and socially, and educationally, and the list goes on. So first, let's look at the definition of patriarchy, which literally means rule of the father. Scholars and archaeologists point to about 6,000 years ago, 4,000 BCE, when this dominance of fatherhood took root. Before then, they think societies were mostly egalitarian. This is simply the theory that the most desirable social organization is one where people are equal. One of the oldest known slogans of egalitarianism is, quote, we all have the same stomachs, unquote. That's a funny one. It's that simple. Everyone eats. No one goes hungry. That is egalitarianism at its core. So then, 6,000 years ago, all of that changed. So now we have 6,000 years of men holding dominant power, 6,000 years of men centralizing and monopolizing political power, 6,000 years of men positioning themselves as the primary moral and spiritual authority, 6,000 years of men enjoying unequal levels of social privilege and control of property. So the fight for the right to vote for women was a very important and very long struggle, rooted very deeply. Also, get this, archaeologists and anthropologists have never come across a society where women dominated men. So I wondered again, how is this explained? Some current views fall on the spectrum that men might be in charge because they are better at it. I once read an article where a man said, quote, "The people who hold that our culture is an oppressive patriarchy, they don't want to admit that the current hierarchy might be predicated on competence," unquote. Lest you think that statement was made in 1820. No, it was made in 2020. But this man was just following a long tradition. Prior to the 20th century, it was a commonly held view that men were intellectually superior to women. Countless religions supposed that male domination is ordained by God. So let's be honest here. Patriarchy divides just about everything into that which is male and that which is female, and privileges the former over the latter. Voting rights were no different. By and large, white women were kept from voting in America through 1920, black women and other women of color through 1965. Why have so many men turned to the economic exploitation and social marginalization of women? And we won't say this is universal, but largely women throughout Europe, the Middle East and Asia and Africa and even the Americas didn't have as much influence over politics, religion and culture as men. They couldn't own property or inherit land and wealth, and they were frequently treated as mere property themselves. Again, this is not universal. There are a great deal of exceptions to the rule, matriarchal lineages, but the males were still kings. Even in these matriarchal lineages, they were still the chiefs. They were still the dominant force. We go back to ancient Greece. The enlightened and democratic Greece, women had no property or political rights there. They couldn't even leave home after dark. So these are the worst of the patriarchal manifestations. And let's be clear, I'm not saying everything about the rule of the father is bad. But think critically this way. Imagine the opposite. A world where women are exclusively in power. A world where males did not have an equal opportunity to campaign for positions of power. A matriarchal society where half of its population was deemed unfit to rule for no reason other than their gender. A society where no matter what a man's individual qualities are, he'll often be stuck in a subordinate position. One where a bad female leader would always be appointed over any man because men never got the top leadership spot, even if he was better suited. You can't imagine that world because it's never existed. And this is what these women were up against as they fought for suffrage. So where can we go to find the first examples of American suffrage? Everyone wants to look at the first, right? Some think that some of the first documented words of feminist thought in America were penned by Abigail Adams, wife of second president and founding father John Adams. Many people cite her and a letter to her husband where she said, "Remember the ladies." She says, quote, "I desire you would remember the ladies and be more generous and favorable to them than your ancestors. Do not put such unlimited power into the hands of husbands. Remember, all men would be tyrants if they could. If particular care and attention is not paid to the ladies, we are determined to foment a rebellion and will not hold ourselves bound by any laws in which we have no voice or representation," unquote. But historian Edith Gell said that Adams considered her domestic role primary. She argues that Abigail was not the first feminist by saying, quote, "Some 20th century historians have painted a false picture of Adams as a radical feminist, citing her 1776 letter to her husband in which she urged him to remember the ladies and be more generous and favorable to them than your ancestors. That sounds like a strong feminist demand that women be treated as equals to men." But the letter goes on to ask John to, quote, "Regard us then as beings placed by providence under your protection, and in imitation of the supreme being, make use of that power only for our happiness," unquote. This historian goes on to say, Abigail Adams had a strong sense of hierarchy and accepted the patriarchal order she felt was ordained by God, unquote. Well, if Adams' claim as the mother of suffrage is questionable, where can we go? Now, popular history would have us believe that in 1848, the Seneca Falls Convention was the first ever women's rights convention and the catalyst to women's suffrage. But Seneca Falls wasn't really the first convention where women talked about their rights. For that, we have to go back further, a decade before Seneca Falls, to what happened in the year of 1837. A decade before the Seneca Falls Convention, black and white women came together at the 1837 Anti-Slavery Convention, which was the first instance of political organizing by American women. Born out of the intersectional struggles of race and gender, black and white women came together with an equality of purpose, abolish slavery, and uplift women's rights as a whole. Imagine the courage of these women who came together to transform the nation. The women at this first convention in New York were groundbreaking pioneers, allying in their indignation to challenge slavery and patriarchy. When we hear of the suffrage movement, we hear how it was marred in racism, but this is a great example of an interracial coalition, however rare they were. So we have to ask the critical question, why was this convention lost in the history books? Was it the interracial character? Most people don't even know about it. Here's why I remember the name of those such as Angela Grimke. Grimke is quoted as saying about inviting black delegates to the convention, quote, "It is all important that we begin right. And I know no way is likely to destroy the cruel prejudices that exist as to bring our sisters in contact with those who shrink from such intercourse," unquote. This was a white woman who was a nonconformist, because for her to be a conformist would have been for her to follow the family tradition of slave ownership. Grimke ran away and became an anti-slavery and women's rights activist. Nowadays, people would call her an ally. But that word doesn't go deep enough. She wasn't an ally. This was a sister in the fight against slavery, racism, and sexism. Now, if you're like me, you've watched one of your favorite TV shows or been watching a great movie or reading an excellent book when suddenly a character shows up and your only reaction is, wait, who is that again? With that said, there are far too many women to name who dedicated their lives to suffrage. If I leave someone out, just know I tried. But this is a concise history and this is the cliff notes. But I really want to try to highlight those like Grimke, who had immense integrity and morality. Then we go to another figure in women's suffrage before Seneca Falls. We turn to the legacy of black American teacher, abolitionist, and lecturer Maria W. Stewart. She was the first American woman, black or white, to speak in front of an audience of men and women. She had written a controversial 12-page pamphlet, Religion and the Pure Principles of Morality, in 1831, telling black people to rise up against slavery in the South and racial restrictions in the North. It was a call for open rebellion, and it placed her in the long tradition of militant abolitionists. The first woman to speak up publicly against the double threat of racism and sexism was Stewart. What a fascinating life she lived, rising from an orphan to activist to teacher. A former enslaved children later in life. Extraordinary figure. In the book American Women's Suffrage, Susan Ware says this about Stewart. Quote, "When Maria W. Stewart stepped forward to embody the women question by speaking in public, she was a 29-year-old widow. In all, she gave four lectures in 1832 before leaving her public career behind to settle in New York and later Washington, D.C. Her early advocacy of what can be seen as a black feminist stance confirms the central role African American women played from the beginning in the struggle for women's rights," unquote. Then Stewart herself asked a critical question, quote, Who shall go forward and take of the reproach that is cast upon the people of color? Shall it be a woman? She goes on to say, such is the powerful force of prejudice. Let our girls possess what amiable qualities of soul they may. Let their characters be fair and spotless as innocence itself. Let their natural tastes and ingenuity be what they may. It is impossible for scarce an individual of them to rise above the condition of servants, unquote. Another quote of Stewart's that shows her courage and fortitude in speaking up in the face of her social catastrophe was, quote, shall I, for fear of feeble man who shall die, hold my peace? Shall I, for fear of scoffs and frowns, refrain my tongue? Ah, no. You can hear the sound of a mic dropping after that one. So we can see that black and white women had been speaking up, writing private letters, conducting public lectures, and producing pamphlets well before Seneca Falls, which is known as the center of the universe for the women's suffrage movement. A half century of feminist writing and political activism preceded Seneca Falls, providing both an intellectual framework and fearless role models for those suffragists like Anthony and Stanton who took suffrage mainstream. And then we get to Seneca Falls. On July 19, 1848, a convention gathered in the small town of Seneca Falls, New York, to declare women's rights. One might wonder why this most celebrated convention of the women's rights struggle was held in a tiny enclave like Seneca Falls and not an urban center like New York City. Well, to understand that, we have to understand the tradition of the Quakers. This rambunctious and rebellious religious group had a center in Seneca Falls. And this is fascinating because anytime I have delved into the history of white people who've involved themselves in black freedom struggles or women freedom struggles on the East Coast of America in the 19th century, I find these Quakers. As a matter of fact, of the five women who met in 1848 to draw up the Declaration of Sentiments, which was essentially the Declaration of Women's Rights at Seneca Falls, of those five, all but one of them were Quakers. So after a Quaker worship on Sunday, July 9th, 1848, Lucretia Mott, joined by Mary Ann McClintock, Martha Coffin Wright, Mott's sister, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, and Jane Hunt were there. Stanton was the only non-Quaker. And it makes me wonder, what was it about this Quaker tradition that helped produce these white freedom fighters? Historian Connie Green Gritz says this about the Quakers. Quote, in the mid-1600s, a new independent religious sect was founded whose values and beliefs were against the convention of the Church of England. This new sect called themselves the Society of Friends or Quakers, whose faith and practices were so radical that persecution fell upon them. Ultimately, this persecution and their desire for spiritual freedom led them to flee England and establish a religious haven in Pennsylvania. Quaker worship, way of life, and custom of dressing all made the Friends easy targets for the strict English religion and government. Their style of worship was an oddity by itself. They had no clergy, no pulpit, no ceremony, nor did they worship in a church. Quakers met in a simple meeting house with rows of benches and a partition to separate the men and women. No one spoke unless moved to speak by God. Then if so moved, anyone was permitted to speak, man or woman. The Quakers' quirky and radical differences in appearance, practices, and beliefs spurred persecution of the Friends. As everyone knows, Quakers were and are pacifists, in most cases refusing to bear arms during conflict. They refused to remove their hats to those in authority or who were considered financially and socially their superior. They refused this practice because Quakers believed all men were equal. Quakers felt that a man should remove his hat only in the presence of God, unquote. So this is the radical tradition these women have come from, a nonconformist religious tradition steeped in equality before God. So this is a new and story, right? Because the freedoms for women that those like Susan B. Anthony was about to dedicate her young life to. Anthony was only 28 at this convention, was something honorable to be fought for, though you'll see that her and other white suffragists get called out for their racism. No one would argue that their fighting for women's suffrage wasn't a good fight. And I'm going to call out the racism too. Those like Anthony, trust me, I will get there, but we can't ignore their role in the story. I also don't want to discount the merits that Even middle-class white women were fighting for. They were fighting for rights to their property, fighting so that their husbands could no longer have full control over their land, jewelry, and valuables. Fighting for the right to make a will, to own a business, fighting against laws that allowed them to be committed to mental institutions by their husbands for almost any reason without their consent, fighting so they could have equal guardianship over their own flesh and blood children, fighting against domestic violence when there was no concept of domestic violence because common law dictated that a husband could beat and chastise and even rape his wife physically, verbally, mentally, or however he saw fit. The vote and seats of power would help them change these laws. They were fighting to release themselves from the same patriarchal inferiority Shakespeare wrote about when he said of women, quote, "Thy husband is thy lord, thy life, thy keeper, thy head, thy sovereign, one that cares for thee, and for thy maintenance commits his body to painful labor both by sea and land, to watch the night in storms, the day in cold, whilst thou liest warm at home, secure and safe," unquote. Good old Shakespeare for you. This is why the enfranchisement of women to be able to vote was so important, to have agency and autonomy. Now, where we have sympathy for white women as legal slaves to their husbands, countless black women were legal slaves in all walks of life forever. So as much empathy that we bring forth to the white women in this movement, I have to bring that tenfold when thinking about the black women of this era, many of which were still enslaved. We have to remember millions of black women weren't even acknowledged as full citizens with legal capacity and political consent. Those black women who were not included or even counted as fully human, who were not even the owners of their own bodies with the ability to withhold consent. In the southern states, they weren't even acknowledged as people deserving of humane treatment and legal protection. So I just want to highlight the inequality in experience and how black women had much more catastrophe visited upon them than white women. And to say, when we talk about suffrage, we can't look at the women's and women's suffrage as an all-woman thing. It wasn't. Because even when there was solidarity among the races, the plight of black women was much more urgent. So back to the Declaration of Sentiments, which was read aloud by Elizabeth Cady Stanton, one of the convention's organizers, and amended after some discussion. The next day, Stanton again read the declaration aloud to the audience of women and men who would sign it, including abolitionist Frederick Douglass. So just as I mentioned earlier, this idea of what we might see as patriarchy isn't some monolithic thing because there were men there at Seneca Falls, including Douglass. I have to admire his deep commitment to this because as a former slave fighting slavery would have been the default, right? But then he goes further and marries himself to the cause of women's rights. What did Frederick Douglass say? Quote, "A woman should have every honorable motive to exertion which is enjoyed by man, to the full extent of her capacities and endowments. The case is too plain for argument. Nature has given woman the same powers and subjected her to the same earth, breathes the same air, subsists on the same food, physical, moral, mental, and spiritual. She has, therefore, an equal right with man in all efforts to obtain and maintain a perfect existence," unquote. Very radical thing to say during this time. So this Declaration of Sentiments is a profoundly important piece of paper to come out of Seneca Falls because it asserted what the women thought to be their inalienable rights, modeled after the Declaration of Independence. It asserted that women possess the same natural rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness as men. Then you have Stanton's words when she says, quote, "The history of mankind is a history of repeated injuries and usurpations on the part of man toward woman, having in direct object the establishment of an absolute tyranny over her," unquote. The declaration itself concludes, quote, because women do feel themselves aggrieved, oppressed, and fraudulently deprived of their most sacred rights, we insist that they have immediate admission to all the rights and privileges which belong to them as citizens of these United States, unquote. So what was the response when women laid out their demands for equal rights? What was the feedback? Some, like Douglas and a lot of the women's abolitionist friends, were in support, but it seems they were the few. Some papers reported the events as they had occurred with no opinions. Then there were a great deal who viciously ridiculed the event. Preachers denounced the meeting. It was heavily criticized. Imagine standing up for equality to be dehumanized and eviscerated verbally. Then there were the Fairweather friends. The declaration was signed by 100 men and women. Many of them withdrew their names as soon as the storm of ridicule was unleashed. Like this scathing attack from the Massachusetts Courier, which said, quote, "The women folks have just held a convention up in New York State and passed a sort of Bill of Rights. They should have resolved at the same time that it was obligatory upon the lords to wash dishes, scour up, be put to the tub, handle the broom, darn stockings, patch breeches, scold the servants, dress in the latest fashion, wear trinkets, look beautiful, and be as fascinating as those blessed morsels of humanity whom God gave to preserve that rough animal man in something like a reasonable civilization," unquote. This was not uncommon. This was not a radical statement. You all, this is how people thought. This is how men thought. Get in the kitchen, wash the dishes, take care of the kids, out of sight, out of mind. Or take this wonderful commentary from the Philadelphia Public Ledger and Daily Transcript, which said, quote, "A woman is nobody. A wife is everything. A pretty girl is equal to 10,000 men, and a mother is next to God, all powerful. The ladies of Philadelphia, therefore, under the influence of the most serious, sober second thoughts, are resolved to maintain their rights as wives, belles, virgins, and mothers, and not as women," unquote. Stanton says in her book, 80 Years or More, quote, "No words could express our astonishment on finding, a few days afterward, that what seemed to us so timely, so rational, and so sacred should be a subject for sarcasm and ridicule. The anti-slavery papers stood by us manfully, as did Frederick Douglass, but so pronounced was the popular voice against us that most of the ladies who had attended the convention and signed the declaration one by one withdrew their names and influence and joined our persecutors. Our friends gave us the cold shoulder and felt themselves disgraced by the whole proceeding," unquote. But this ridicule couldn't stop the movement. Maybe, just maybe, thousands of years of welled up oppression amongst women could no longer be contained. The convention touched a responsive chord in the hearts of women all over the country. Women's rights meetings started popping up as if by magic, someone said, in New York, Indiana, Pennsylvania, Massachusetts, and Ohio. Quote, "For those who do not yet understand the real objects of the recent conventions at Rochester and Seneca Falls, I would state that we did not meet to discuss fashions, customs, or dress, the rights or duties of man, nor the propriety of the sexes changing positions, but simply our own inalienable rights, our duties, our true spheres," Stanton said. This passion for justice and rallying cry was felt amongst so many women across the nation that these rallies started springing up everywhere. Now it would be remiss if I didn't mention another convention in 1850 that intersected the struggles of race and women's rights. This was the first National Women's Rights Convention in Worcester, Massachusetts. It invited all men and women with an interest in the subject of women's rights to appear. Another convention that did call attention to black women, a convention that called on participants to remember the 2 million slave women in the South, to which someone was quoted saying, quote, "the most grossly wronged and outraged of all women," unquote. Now, we know the black women were active in the suffrage struggle during this time, but they were ignored, largely segregated, and unmentioned in history. But there is one towering figure that stands out in that history, and that is Sojourner Truth. towering not only because she was tall, but for what she stood tall for. She was the first known black woman suffragist. It is said that Truth was a fiery orator, captivating even unwilling and skeptical audiences. Remember that in a lot of these crowds, suffragists were speaking to hostile audiences. So imagine this tall, strong, dark-skinned, self-emancipated black woman getting up, speaking with the force of the wind, shedding her slave name, Isabella Bomfree, for the name Sojourner After Truth, even though she was dehumanized, stigmatized, and marginalized by the white suffragists, she still got up and advocated for all women. Now remember, when I read this, Truth was illiterate, but she said this at an 1853 meeting, quote, "I've been looking around and watching things, and I know a little about women's rights, too. I know it feels a little tickling to see a colored woman get up here and tell you about things, but we have all been thrown down so low that nobody thought we'd ever get up again. But we have been long enough downtrodden. Now we will come up again. And now I am here. Now women do not ask half a kingdom, but their rights, and they don't get them. When she comes to demand them, don't you hear our sons hiss their mothers like snakes because they ask for their rights? See if we don't. And you can't stop us from them. See if you can. You may hiss as much as you like, but it's coming." The model and plans for a women's suffrage statue that was to go up in Central Park in New York only included two of the white leaders. Only after protest did Sojourner Truth get added as the third woman, even though we can see her outsized contribution to the movement. And I can just imagine the power in her speech as she gives this sort of firm prediction. No matter how much men groan and moan and bicker about it, women would have their rights. No one can stop destiny. So at this juncture in the story, I just want to pause for a minute because I'm about to get into some of the deeper elements of racism that befell the mainstream suffrage movement. Many people have jumped at the chance to call out the racism. I take the perspective that those who fail to learn from the mistakes of our predecessors are destined to repeat them. So I recount this story to be a lesson to women and all human beings to come together. It's one of those histories, what if moments. What if racism didn't seep into the suffrage movement? What if white women could have found solidarity in their gender struggles across race and class on a large scale? So when did racism really rear its head in the suffrage movement? It was over the question of whether black male suffrage could coexist with women's suffrage. At this point in the story, slavery is abolished. Then the question of the day had become black male suffrage. You had those like Frederick Douglass who argued that black men faced a dire urgency to vote because black people were being lynched and murdered. Many former abolitionists shared this urgency and said women needed to wait for their time. It was coming, but this wasn't it. As the white abolitionist Wendell Phillips stated, quote, "One question at a time, this hour belongs to the Negro," unquote. So there was this attitude of black men first, women second. This strategy made sense for black people facing existential threats of discrimination and violence after emancipation, anti-black terrorism. There was this new group, you might have heard of them, they were called the Ku Klux Klan. They were wreaking havoc and horror on black communities, lynching, murdering, raping, and terrorizing. This dire situation led congressional Republicans to draft the 14th and 15th Amendments, which enshrined rights for black men by defining them as citizens. Yet by granting citizenship and voting to all men, the amendments marginalized women. White suffragists such as Stanton responded with outrage that black men, whom they considered racially inferior, were enfranchised before them. Stanton in particular was bitter and turned vicious in her attacks. I think this is where people say a revolution without love is just another form of tyranny. Her language promoted racism and female superiority when she said, quote, "The male element is a destructive force, stern, selfish, aggrandizing. Loving war, violence, conquest, acquisition, breeding in the material and moral world alike discord, disorder, disease, and death. Only the female element, representing power, virtue, morality, true religion, could save the nation. To raise the lowliest of men above the most elevated of women, she said, was a deliberate insult to the women of the nation, unquote. I don't think she had to agree with her old brothers, Wendell Phillips and Frederick Douglass. But my disagreement with Stanton is that she took the low road instead of the high road. She no longer envisioned universal suffrage, but suffrage for educated middle-class white women at the expense of the dignity and humanity of black men and women. Here's another quote. Here she says, by denying white women the vote, they, quote, degraded their own mothers, wives, and daughters below unwashed and unlettered ditch diggers, bootblacks, hustlers, butchers, and barbers, unquote. These deeply racist and classist slurs were all in there. In another popular quote, she said, quote, imagine Patrick, an Irish slur, and Sambo, and Hans, and Young Tongue, who do not know the difference between a monarchy and a republic, who never read the Declaration of Independence, making laws for refined, educated, Anglo-Saxon women reformers, unquote. After the May 1869 meeting of the Equal Rights Association in New York, Anthony would betray her longtime friend Frederick Douglass, who was vice president of the association. Imagine this large and animated audience, which was 90% women, and everyone is energized for a rally in solidarity for women's rights. Then, right as Douglass and Anthony get on stage, Anthony surprises Douglass with a fierce debate. A debate he had no clue he was entering into. She challenged Douglass, asking, quote, would he ever exchange his sex and color, unquote. She jabbed Douglass, who was a former slave, saying, quote, they think of some of us as slaveholders, used to think of their slaves, all love and compassion with no malice in their hearts, unquote. She chastised Douglass for a previous statement he made about how black men needed the vote more urgently because of their perilous situation. We're in for a fight today, she said. It has been noted that Douglass responded with remarkable grace, giving as he took and trying to defuse Anthony's rage with humor, even under this vicious attack. Then he resisted her equivalence of women's rights to that of the black man, stating, and imagine he is specifically talking about white women here when he says, quote, when women, because they are women, are hunted down in the cities of New York and New Orleans, when they are dragged from their houses and are hung up from lampposts, when their children are torn from their arms and their brains bashed out upon the pavement, when they are in danger of having their homes burnt down over their heads, then they will have an urgency to obtain the ballot equal to our own. Unquote. Was Douglass wrong? He knew that black male suffrage was in reach while women's suffrage was farther away. Should he have given up fighting for the black male vote, which was immediately attainable, for a universal suffrage fight that was decades from winning? Anthony disagreed, but it was her vicious attack steeped in racism and classism that cut to the core of those who spent their lives fighting for black freedom. Remember, the suffrage movement was born out of the abolitionist movement, so the question here becomes, should Stanton and Anthony have accepted a half measure of black male suffrage while working toward a longer revolution? This would have been the pragmatic thing to do. Imagine also how those black women felt, those who never abandoned the suffrage movement, those who worked tirelessly and simultaneously toward the joint goals of racial and gender equality. Douglass and Anthony never reconciled, even though there is a statue in Rochester, New York, that was erected in 2001 in honor of them. It is called Let's Have Tea because the sculptor portrays Anthony and Douglass across from each other having tea. So now if you walk past that statue, just know the tea was bitter. Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Susan B. Anthony, and many others would go their own way. They had assumed that the rights of women would be championed alongside the rights of black men, and they opposed the black male vote based on women's exclusion. Other reformers like Lucy Stone and Mary Livermore, though not happy, supported the black male vote amendment anyway. They feared, as did a number of male legislators, that if women were included, the amendment would not pass and no new suffrage rights would be won. So then this was the reason for the great schism in the women's suffrage movement. It was over race. So we end this episode on a cliffhanger, except you know how the story ends, or do you? Would universal suffrage be achieved in the years to come? If so, for who? In the next episode, I will finish this story, but just know that women's voting rights is known as the long struggle. I often compare fights for justice to a marathon. Imagine this quote about running by Japanese writer Haruki Murakami, but apply it to the suffrage movement and the fight for equality. Quote, "Of course it was painful. And there were times when, emotionally, I just wanted to chuck it all. But pain seems to be a precondition for this kind of sport. If pain were involved, who in the world would ever go to the trouble of taking part in sports like the triathlon or the marathon, which demand such an investment of time and energy? It's precisely because of the pain, precisely because we want to overcome the pain, that we can get the feeling through this process of really being alive, or at least a partial sense of it. Your quality of experience is based not on standards such as time or ranking, but on finally awakening to an awareness of the fluidity within action itself. For each and every woman involved in the suffrage movement, named and unnamed, those who fought daily to overcome that pain of their daily lives, who awakened and found life in that fluidity of action toward justice, who realized this was a long run and they may not make it to the end, but they kept running anyway. This is in their honor. Would women get the right to vote? Yes, but if you want to know the details of how and how that struggle continues, you have to join me next time. See you in part two. Thank you, thank you, thank you. This is a re-record and remaster of my original women's suffrage podcast, one of the first podcasts that I ever recorded. So I hope you enjoyed it. I hope you learned from it. I hope you were intellectually stimulated by it. And I hope that you were, and I hope that it moved you in some way. Again, my Black History book is out, The Humanity Archive, Recovering the Soul of Black History from a Whitewashed American Myth. Pick that up. But I really want you to join me over in my Patreon community, because that is going to help sustain the Humanity Archive forever. Allow me to do this podcast as long as I'm breathing, which I would love to do. But I can't do it without your support. I need you all to help me keep the lights on over here. So go over to patreon.com/The Humanity Archive. Put in for $5 a month or $12.99 a month or $20 a month, whatever you can afford. And then you're going to get a bonus podcast to be able to hang out with me during office hours, access to my book club, and so much more. Thank you all for listening. I'm Jermaine Fowler, and I'll see you next time.